I am Marilyn McCarney. Betsy Payette and I are interviewing personnel who are instrumental in developing Renfrew Museum and Park. Today is February 18, 1992, and Mr. Terry Pelton is being interviewed. Terry Pelton has been at Renfrew since 1987 and has worked full-time restoring its buildings, particularly the Fauna Stock Barn, the Smokehouse, and the Milk House.
My name is Terry Pelton. I worked as a design engineer for Landis Machine Company from 1974 to 1987 is when I quit. Originally from Ohio, I moved here for my job at the machine company. During my time at the machine company, I got very interested in period woodworking, basically late 18th century, early 19th century. I was doing a lot of repair work and workshops, further my education and my clientele, I suppose. I was trying to start a business with my woodworking. And so I was doing workshops for the museums. And I came to Renfrew and had done a workshop on Windsor chairs. They seemed interested in what I was doing, and we kept in contact after that. In 1986, Renfrew told me about the project they had in mind about restoring the Fauna Stock Barn. Wanted to know if I'd be interested in the job at all. I thought about it. I did quit my job in November of 1986. I got hired in January of 1987 at Renfrew. The first thing I did was familiarize myself with the barn, see basically what I had to work with. And then we ordered all the timbers for the buildings. We had a partial list of materials needed to be replaced, but the list wasn't nearly complete. But what we did is we went over, and I personally made lists of everything that seemed to be replaced. We ordered the logs from a man named Ken Swisher, who is the forestry department head in Mon Aldo campus at Penn State. He, over the next year and a half, he cut timbers for me off the Waynesboro watershed up at South Mountain. We had the timbers delivered, and I believe it was in April when I started to broad axe these beams. I really had no idea how to broad axe. We slowly learned it. A lot of blisters, a lot of screwed up beams, but we slowly learned how to do it. In June, I started to take the barn down. It was in real bad condition, and the only way to repair it was completely take it down. It's not a job I do by myself, so I hired a man named Kenny Lemon, who is a native of Waynesboro. Kenny and I took 5 weeks to take it down. And in the process, we found out we needed more help, so we hired Bob North and Mike Lear. Mike was basically a gopher. He lined stuff up for us, did little things we had to do. But then Bob North, Kenny Lemon, and I finished taking the barn down. After the barn was down, we maintained Kenny as an employee here to help me. He basically did a lot of cleanup work while I finished broad axing the beams. The barn raising was scheduled for springtime of 87, which it took us a lot longer to do the broad axing and the joinery than what we thought. So we delayed it till September of 88. And also we decided we needed another person hired, so we hired Joe Farrell. Now, I taught Joe how to broad axe, and then Kenny, Joe, and I finished doing the joinery and getting it ready for the barn raising. Barn raising was, I think, on September 29th, 1988, which time we had it was a beautiful day. We got everything done we expected to get done, which was basically the square of the barn, which amounted to three vents and the top plates. And then the rest of the winter of 88 and into 89, we put the roof rafters on, we put the granary on, the forebay, and then that's when Kenny and Joe left, employment on Renfro, and I was on my own again, which I finished putting the roofing on and the siding. And we finished it up for dedication in September of 89. And then after that, I took the winter off to kind of recuperate and catch up on my furniture business, which I've been neglecting. And then in March of 90, I believe it was 90, I started broad axing the beams for the milk house, which time between broad axing the beams, I also took the building down. I got a parts list. It took me 3 months to broad ax the beams for that, or the logs. And then in June, I started to join them together, which amounted to a German V-notch. I did basically the work with a foot adze and a hatchet. Took me, I think, 5 weeks to put the logs up on it, another 3 or 4 weeks to put the roof on it. And then it had to set for a while to let all the beams age. They were all green and they tend to shrink. There's daubing and wood chinking that goes in between the logs. And if you put them in before the beams are shrunk up, you know, finished, you know, aging, all the stuff will fall out. So we let it set almost a year. And in this time we were waiting, I started to redo the smokehouse. The smokehouse really was probably in the best shape. It had been worked on in, I believe, late 1890s. Had a whole new roof system put on it. So what I had to do was take the roof system that had been replaced. It had a lot of dimension timbers in it, as in like 2x4s and 2x10s. Instead of having original broad-axed or hand-hewed beams, they had laminated like 2x10s together to replace the plates. And, all this had to be redone. So I tore it down, and in that winter, I spent the time, you know, replacing all the roof system on that. And then in the springtime, I did stonework around it, repointed, replaced some of the stonework that had come apart, reworked some of the windows on the inside on the washhouse part downstairs. And then I think it was in around opening weekend in April is when I finished up the smokehouse, and then left me to go back to work on the milk house. The milk house, most terrible job was the mud daubing. We wanted to get an original type daubing, which consisted of clay, lime, and hog's hair. The hog's hair was real hard to come by. We tried all kind of different places to get it, different sources. We needed hand-scraped hog's hair, which they mechanically scrape it now, you get too much flesh with it. We finally found farmers that did it individually, and this is what we, you know, used. Then we got clay delivered. It was just plain red clay, and then we bought slack lime, and then I went the process of kneading the clay with my feet, mixing it with water, mixing the lime in it and the hog's hair, and then applying it. It took about 2 months to do. It was a really grueling job. Then we lime coated it on top of that. I was getting cracks in it. The lime filled in all the cracks, gave me a nice top coat. And then I finished the job up. There was little odds and ends that had to be done in the barn, the milk house, and the smokehouse. And my job was over at the beginning of November in 1991. Okay. Mud daubing for the smokehouse or the milk house was kind of a problem. We had no idea how to do this. We had the finished product. We had the original daubing from the milk house, which was gives some idea how good this stuff is when it's done correctly. This was almost 200 years old. We had it analyzed. It was clay, mostly clay, about two-thirds clay, one-third lime, and hog's hair is mixed in for binding. The clay was easy to come by. There's red clay everywhere around here. The slack lime I bought knitter houses up in Chambersburg, but the hog's hair was the hard part. We looked everywhere. We tried a Mennonite butcher shop. They had it, but it was mechanically removed and a lot of flesh came with it. We end up finding it from George Bucky's farm down in Buckystown. They still do small-time butchering, which they were hand-scraping. After I gathered up all the materials, I made a mud box. It was about 5 foot square. And I'd loaded up about 4 or 5 wheelbarrows full of clay I'd put in it and add lots of water to it and just get in with my feet and take my shoes off, and I wore my knickers, and I just get in, and it would take me about 3 hours of just kneading the clay with my feet. This was a traditional way of doing the clay. A lot of brick makers did it this way, and mud daubers. In fact, they eventually, you know, I believe in the early 1800s, they came up with a mechanical way of kneading the clay. But the old brick makers didn't like it. They said it wasn't as good as when it was mixed by the feet. I've heard that they even got cows in sometimes to knead it, but it was a very grueling job on your feet. My feet peeled. They stepped on stones and stuff, and they hurt. Your feet get real tender after a while. I haven't been in the water all the time. After about 3 hours of kneading it, I would get small sections out. This is when I got my proportions to my clay and my lime. I would get like 2 or 3 scoops full of clay and 1 scoop of lime. It was more or less, you went by the feel of it. Sometimes you added more or less lime to it. Then I get in, mix with my feet the lime and the clay together. Then I would take the hog's hair, pull it apart, and mix it in. The hog's hair, the clay as it dries, it cracks. It's a natural thing that when the clay dries, it does crack. And what the hog's hair does serves as a binding. So it, even though it cracks, it still holds together, and which drove me crazy for a while. I couldn't figure out why it was cracking. I tried all different types of proportion difference. I even tried a lot of sand in it, which really wasn't proper, but I was getting pretty frustrated by that time. And so finally, I came up with the idea that, hey, maybe it's supposed to crack. There's nothing I can do about it. And I noticed the original line or original daubing had a fairly thick coat of lime on top of it. It just looked like almost a whitewash or a plaster coat. So I applied all the clay and let it dry. I covered it with burlap to help slow down the drying process. I got sheets of burlap, and every day at the end of the day I would cover the clay up with the daubing I'd already applied with the burlap and hose it down. And I left this on for as long as I could until, you know, as I got done mud daubing the whole thing, then I took all the burlap down. But I'd keep hosing it and to slow down the drying process. And when I slowed it down, it also reduced a lot of the cracks I was getting. But there were still a lot of cracks, but everything was tight. And then I mixed up clay and water, just made a real thick whitewash mixture, and then applied a coat. And it filled in all the cracks, and then I went back with a second thin coat of whitewash, and then just coated it, and it seemed to work fine. It's held for almost a year now, and no cracks that came back. So I think I hopefully got it. But it was a tough mixture that I was glad I finally came up with. The barn is actually 5 different sections. The basic square is the center of the barn, which we'd raised during barn raising. The other parts would be the forebay, the entrance, and the granary. They were all built basically separate and then attached. As far as I can see, this is the way all barns were made. And, you have to put the square up first, and then we put up the forebay, the entranceway, or the granary, the entranceway, and then the forebay was the last thing we did. And then, of course, the roof rafters. When I was redoing the barn, when we first started, we ran into red lines in the center of almost every beam in the place. And most of the red lines are still on the original beams back there. It was one of the ways I could tell if a beam had been replaced or not over the years. Because every beam in the place, even in the stables, had a red line, like a chalk line. I believe it was vanadium red that they were using, some sort of permanent dye. No one knew what these lines were. Drove me crazy for a while. Lived with them for a year and a half and never knew what they were. And there was too much effort put into them not to have a purpose. And But we finally figured out what it was when we went to lay out the, to do the joinery on the barn. They used no tape measures or square. That, as far as I can tell, everything was laid out with a string, which is the easiest way to do it. You drive yourself crazy with measurements on it. There's nothing real exact on it, but a string is close enough, and it works the best. As I brought actually beams, some of them were 40 feet long, and they would warp within a week after I got them done. They'd be perfectly straight when I did them. Within a week, they'd be bowed as much as 3 or 4 inches. And when you go to lay out the joinery on it, it's just too difficult and too complicated to take all the measurements and adjust for these warps, because every piece was warped. And what we finally figured out they had done is they had taken and snapped the red chalk line from the centers of each end, and which gave them a theoretically straight line to work off of. Then they took all their string measurements off of these red lines on the barn, or on these beams. The top plates had the red lines, the uprights had them. The uprights you would line up straight or square as you could possibly get them by eye. Then you measure diagonal distance with a string from one chalk line diagonally across to the other one on the uprights. And then you'd check it the other direction, and if both diagonals were correct, it meant that the beams were square to each other. But this, as far as I could tell, this is the way the Germans would have done it, at least the way they did it in our barn back here. Barn itself is kind of weird. We did a lot of research on other barns in the area, and we found out there's almost an evolution of these buildings. I couldn't find any that predates the Faunestock barn. I found some that it's like a refining process. You learn as you go. Like if the next barn I was going to build, I would change things that they had done. You see mistakes that you made. One's a forebay is too long. It has an 8-foot forebay. Just about every other barn I've seen in this area had a 5-foot forebay. The forebay was real nice and straight on this barn until we finished putting, the forebay floor was straight. We raised the forebay wall and put the roof rafters on it, and it sags now about 3 inches, which would indicate the cantilever is too long on it. It won't support the weight as well as it should. So what they did is they shortened it. A lot of other little mistakes they made, which were hard for me not to crack, because you see the end product, how it degenerates the barn over the years, but I had to build them in. The double top plates were a real puzzler for us. I couldn't understand why they'd go to the trouble of broad axing 3 extra 40-foot beams just to put one on top of the other. I found out they were used to trap the cross plates that the roof rafters join into. I found one where these top plates had been cut out, one barn where the top plate had been removed, or the upper top plate, and it allowed the cross plates to twist out of joint. So what this does was help trap in to help the roof rafters, everything stay together more or less. They eventually evolved away from this system, I think about 1840. I saw a definite hand in most all the barns between, say, 1810 and 1840. It was almost like there's a crew of barn builders that were building these barns, and something must have happened to them, because everything changed about 1840 around here. Barns were built differently after that. So I kind of think there was a crew building these things, or a basic hand that had developed the designs around here. Dating the buildings was a very difficult thing to do, because there's so many generic things done to this. Part of the ways you date it is the design of it, the type of tooling marks, and also the nails being used. When I worked on the milk house, we ran into a real odd nail. It wasn't a cut nail, it wasn't a hand wrought nail, it was like a marriage between the two. It had a cut nail shank, but a hand wrought head. And what we found out is up to about 1790, all nails were handmade or hand wrought, and then about 1800, almost all the nails were completely machine made, or what's called a cut nail. And the nails we were finding in the milk house was they had a machine made shank but a hand wrought head, which Will Shepherd seemed to think probably was done at Burns's Forge, probably at Red Run. But what happened was they had, like I say, a cut nail shank, but yet a hand wrought head. And this was one of the ways we used to date it, because there was about a 10-year period between 1790 and 1800 when they were doing this. They hadn't figured out how to mechanically put a head on these nails yet. And we found probably 200 of these nails in the milk house. Milk house had went through a lot of changes. The roof system had been changed on it. It had been divided into two rooms. I think it was a lot of work was done on it in late 1800s, about 1890, probably by Nancy Faunestock. She was trying to fix a place up to sell it, so she was repairing a lot. She was trying to fix a place up. She had put a wooden, or somebody had put a wooden floor in it. They had plastered the insides. They had cut the whole back log wall out of the south side of the milk house was completely removed. They had raised the ceiling about 7 or 8 inches. Got a very low ceiling in it. Just a storage building, we think. They might have made milk and cheese up in there, but had a very low ceiling. It's about 6 foot. But when they altered it, they raised the roof to make it about 6.5 feet, more of livable space. They added the wall in the middle and plastered everything. They also added a window in the back and a window on the house side. I guess it would be the east side of the building to get light in these two rooms. I put a window in the south side of the milk house. It was an educated guess on my part. If there was a window in it, it would have been on the gable side in the south. But, like I say, the south wall had been completely removed, so I had no evidence whether there was a window in there or not. When they remodeled it, they did add a sash window in the south side. But whether it's correct it's in there or not, I'll never know. But it was an educated guess that they would have had to have some sort of light. Something else that's still a mystery to me, and I'll probably never know, is there is about a 4 or 5 inch space above the door between the top log and the floor to the upper, the gable part. I have no idea why it was in there. It was in there originally. I built the thing exactly the way I interpreted it being built originally, and this space was in there. I don't know whether it was to allow light in, or ventilation, or whether it was just a mistake and they filled in somehow. It would have been a very easy thing to correct, but they didn't. There is evidence that there was some sort of board put up there, because I found whitewash line that indicates there was some barrier in there. Whether it was added later on, I don't know. To me, it doesn't make sense if it was a storage area that you'd leave such a large opening for birds and squirrels and everything else to get in there. But this was, as far as I could tell, an original part of the structure. But I guess I'll never know. But everything else is built exactly from what I can see of what the original was. And one of the ways we could define what was original was by these nails that we found that were so odd. Too much of a secret. Technically, my job at Renfrew is done, except for me working for the Institute as a teacher. Renfrew has been like a home to me. The people I hear are my family. I very much regretted my term out here to being done. We got everything done we wanted to do except the Faunestock house. It's the house next to the barn that we restored, and it was built, as far as we can tell, about 1808. It has been deserted since 1961. basically the building was stabilized, but the interior is really a disaster. The windows are all out of it. There's no doors. The moldings inside are not period correct. They are around Civil War time. And we ran out of money. And so now that I'm done at Renfrew, I am back in my furniture business full time. And I work out of a shop in my basement at my house. And so I guess Renfrew didn't want to lose me any more than I wanted to lose Renfrew. So we kind of worked out a mutual agreement that I could use the Fauna Stock House as my furniture shop for trade, for restoring it. So probably for the next 3 years, hopefully, I'll be trading so much work per year for lease of it, and I'll be making my furniture in the house. We're having electricity ran back this year. I hope to have the windows and the doors and the plastering done on the first floor, so it's usable to me, and it'll also be open for people to come in and watch me work. And you know, it's a way of getting the house restored and giving me a shop and making everybody happy. So.